Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Welcome to a very special episode of City Hall Pass, during which we will celebrate the holiday of Juneteenth. Annually celebrated on June 19th, Juneteenth serves as an homage to the actual ending of slavery in 1865. Bess, Kate, and I recently spoke with three of New York City's leading voices on equity and racial justice: First Lady Shirlane McRae, Deputy Mayor Phil Thompson, and Executive Director of the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, Sadia Sherman, about the meaning and importance of the Juneteenth holiday to each of them. To kick off our special Juneteenth episode, I want to introduce our first guest, the First Lady of New York City, Shirlane McRae. Shirlane McRae has redefined the role of First Lady, managing a robust portfolio focusing on creating a fairer and more equitable city for all of us. Nationally recognized as a powerful advocate for mental health reform, the First Lady created Thrive NYC, the most comprehensive mental health plan of any city or state in the nation. She also serves as co-chair of the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, whose mission is to ensure New York City's recovery from COVID-19 is rooted in fairness and justice. I spoke with the First Lady about what Juneteenth means to her, the connections between Juneteenth and her work as co-chair of the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, her commitment to mental health, and much more. We hope you enjoy. I want to give a very warm welcome to the First Lady of New York City, Shirlane McRae. Thank you, Madam First Lady, for joining us today on City Hall Pass.
That's great to be on your show, Kapel.
Well, we've been trying to get you on for a long time, but your schedule is incredibly busy. So we're truly grateful that you've made some time for us today. And we're here actually to talk about a subject that I know is near and dear to your heart, namely Juneteenth. Madam First Lady, I'd like to start off by talking about what Juneteenth means to you.
Well, you know, I didn't grow up celebrating Juneteenth. It's relatively new to me. It was not in my history books when I was growing up. It was not anything that people talked about. I'm really excited by all of this. For me, Juneteenth is about hope. It's a reminder of the complexity of our country's history. And most importantly, it's a reminder that freedom can never be taken for granted, that it takes more than laws to be free. This country was created and it's maintained by strong laws, but those laws are really just on paper. If the laws aren't in keeping with what's accepted by society, and if the laws are not communicated or enforced, then they're effectively meaningless. And that's what happened with Juneteenth. Juneteenth was born when people who were enslaved in Galveston, Texas, learned on June 19th, 1865, that they were free. And that was more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation became effective on January 1st, 1863. It was a day of celebration when they found out, a day of hope because their future lay before them in a way that it never was before. And the holiday, which combines those words, June and 19th, was historically celebrated in the Southwest, but has become widely observed in recent years.
The history of it is extraordinary, and you've articulated it brilliantly. How, Madam First Lady, do you celebrate Juneteenth?
As I told you, I didn't grow up with it. And so it's only in recent years when I have been able to participate in events across the city and learn about Galveston, Texas, and what it was like back in those days. But I appreciate the holiday and I honor it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful holiday for everyone to come together and celebrate. Black history is American history, and it belongs to all of us. We all share the promise of this country, and we have to work together to actually fulfill that promise. So Juneteenth, it's a wonderful addition to our lexicon of holidays, but a lot of people don't know what it means. So I think that the continued enslavement of Black people in Texas, even after they were legally free, is kind of a metaphor for much of what ails us in this nation. It was justice delayed. We continue to struggle for equity, and we continue to struggle to unveil the history, the real history of this country. So much is not known, you know, not widely known. It's in books and archives and oral histories, but, you know, it is not distributed across the country the way it should be. We have to continue working on that. It's going to take a lot of time before that history actually permeates the mainstream, the history and what that history means, right? The consequences of slavery, the consequences of how these laws were written and not communicated and enforced. All of that, it just takes time to actually permeate the culture.
Well, and it also takes people who use their public platform to educate people. And you, Madam First Lady, along with the mayor, of course, have used your platform since the day you got into Gracie Mansion to talk about equity and fairness. And Juneteenth is just another example of your passion for these concepts. In fact, you are one of three chairs of the Racial Inclusion Equity Task Force, otherwise known as TREE. What connections, Madam First Lady, do you make between the task force and Juneteenth?
I'm so glad you asked that question. One of the major legacies of slavery is how we've been kept apart from one another. Our ancestors were taken from different ethnic groups and sold in different parts of the country to prevent them from communicating with one another. It was all very deliberate. They didn't want people who spoke the same language and had the same cultures and traditions, like all in groups, so they couldn't conspire. It was illegal to read and write. Families were torn apart. Gatherings were discouraged. And the legacy of that has continued almost to this day. As a minority people in this country, and with so many barriers, it has been difficult to build strong, healthy communities and organizations. And Tulsa, Oklahoma is just one example of how difficult it has been to keep our communities intact in a healthy way, to own property, places that are desirable, and control our own destinies. I can tell you stories from my time of that. Many people in the task force are senior leaders, primarily people of color, who understand the mechanics of government and have the power to get things done. And I am so moved. I mean, of course, it's important that we do this work for people, but I am also very moved by the fact that the task force is composed of so many people who are born in these communities, or they've lived and worked in these communities, these 33 communities that we identified as hardest hit by COVID, because it just changes the whole dynamic of communication and is a reflection of how when people come from a community, they value that community differently. So we asked the people in these communities to tell us what they needed. Right? We did surveys, we had conversations, and the task force members, again, who know these communities intimately, were able to listen with empathy and discernment in many cases because they're the same communities they come from. I think it really took that expression, nothing for us without us, to a new level. I am moved because there are so many people of color in this administration that I never knew because, of course, city government is huge. The task force has actually changed that. There's a new and growing network because, again, these are mostly senior leaders who actually understand how to wield the levers of power. It makes a real difference in what we're able to do as a cohesive group.
Madam First Lady, you just talked about the task force and the various achievements that the task force has made. One of the things the task force did was reach out to community members to find out their concerns. And one of the concerns that the community expressed was related to mental health. You, we all know, have been a warrior in the mental health battle and have achieved so much in your 7.5 years in Gracie Mansion. The mayor just signed an executive order establishing a permanent office of mental health here that is going to last far, far longer than any of us and will be here forever as a tribute, frankly, to the work that you've done and hopefully a tribute to the city of New York and all of the people who will be able to use those resources. Madam First Lady, can you talk a little bit about the importance of the creation of that office and your commitment to mental health?
First of all, when we did the survey of these 33 communities, mental health was the number one response under the category of health. It was cited as a need that was of greatest importance to the people. When I saw that, it broke my heart, but it also gave me hope because I knew that if people are able to actually say this is what they need, that's a first step to addressing the concern. we've responded by innovating, by redirecting resources, expanding existing programs, doing everything that we can to actually address the need. All of the things I just talked about, you know, the legacy of slavery, in addition to the difficulties of immigrants and other ethnic groups who live within these 33 communities, you know, have been exacerbated by the pandemic. And many of these communities have been underserved for so many decades. I don't want to make it sound like this is just a few people. These communities represent 4 million people. This is half our city, which is a great example of the disparity, right? The disparity and who has what. Like, so the other 4 million have a lot more. And these 4 million, largely people of color, immigrants, et cetera, are without a lot of basic resources, including broadband. So mental health, what we're trying to do is make sure that it never gets left out of the conversation, because when people don't have mental health services, they're not able to go to school, they're not able to work, they're not able to parent properly, they're not able to have healthy relationships. Without mental health, I mean, there is no health. And if you don't have your health, you don't have anything, right? I mean, you're kind of lacking in your ability to function in the world. So by executive order, the mayor created the Office of Community Mental Health. And it was very important to me to have the word community in it, community mental health, because we know this is the way of the world where services should need to be and should be offered in communities. People should not have to travel an hour, a half hour to some other neighborhood to be delivered services by people they don't know and don't have a relationship. Mental health is so personal, and dysfunction can be expressed in ways that are cultural or different from the way people have been trained. And so it's important for people to have services delivered by people who understand their language, their culture, their traditions. So the Office of Community Mental Health, I hope it goes beyond this administration. I hope it's given the priority in terms of funding, in terms of staffing, that we actually have people from these communities, all of our communities, who are trained and able to deliver place-based services wherever people live, where they learn, where they go to school, all of those places, so that no one goes underserved.
Do you believe that Juneteenth has a special resonance this year in the wake of the pandemic and renewed attention to questions of racial equity and justice?
Yes, most definitely. We've all been through so much in this past year, so much. And we've all had a little bit more time or a little different quality of time to actually pay attention to what's going on. So I hope that Juneteenth comes to me more than just one day and one moment in history. I want it to be a reminder that freedom is not about the laws that are written on paper, that we all have to work for it, and that we all need to come together to fulfill the promise of this country. There's just no other way. It takes all of us. We're in this together.
Indeed we are. And Madam First Lady, thank you again for taking time to talk to us about a subject that is so important to all of us and to educate us about Juneteenth. But I would venture to guess that the vast majority of people do not know the history. And so understanding that history and the way that you explained it to us, it's so valuable. And we're very, very grateful. Thank you, Madam First Lady, for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And thank you for everything you've done for these last 7.5 years for the city of New York. We are truly grateful.
Thank you. I'm grateful for having this opportunity to work with you and have this conversation with you, Cabell.
Thank you, Madam First Lady.
All right.
Hi, this is Kate. I'm excited to introduce our second guest for this episode, Deputy Mayor Phil Thompson. As Deputy Mayor for Strategic Policy Initiatives, Deputy Mayor Thompson is responsible for spearheading a diverse collection of priority initiatives. His portfolio includes agencies such as the Department of Small Business Services, the Commission on Human Rights, and the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Deputy Mayor Thompson also serves as co-chair on the city's Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity and as a commissioner on the city's Racial Justice Commission. I've gotten to know Deputy Mayor Thompson over these last few years at the mayor's office, and he is truly one of a kind and someone that I have a great deal of respect for. He is curious, caring, and creative, and he is always willing to listen and provide advice. So I was truly honored to be able to sit down with Deputy Mayor Thompson to talk about his lifelong commitment to serving the public, the history and significance of Juneteenth, particularly in New York, and his work leading the Racial Justice Commission. We hope you enjoy. I want to welcome Deputy Mayor Phil Thompson to City Hall Pass. Deputy Mayor Thompson, last year at this time, the mayor signed Executive Order 57, which established Juneteenth as a recognized public holiday in New York City. What does Juneteenth mean to you?
I think that many people have the misperception that slavery was something that only affected the southern states and that New York was anti-slavery all along. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. New York in 1700 had the second highest proportion of homeowners or households with slaves in the entire United States. Only Charleston had more per household. 42% of New York households had slaves in 1700. Wall Street, where it hits the East River, was a slave auction. The largest burial ground for slaves is actually right near City Hall, the African burial ground, with 15,000 slaves were buried there in the 1600s and 1700s. The Statue of Liberty is in New York Harbor for a reason. It was actually built by and financed by French anti-slavery activists who at the end of the Civil War financed the building of the statue to commemorate the United States freeing slaves and as a symbol for the whole world of the fight against oppression. And at the bottom of the statue are chains, which are being broken, symbolizing the end of slavery. And the reason why that was important in New York was right up until the Civil War. Even though slavery was outlawed in New York State in 1829, I believe, New York City still remained the finance center for slavery. And the African slave trade to Cuba was financed out of here right up until the Civil War. Food and other provisions for slave plantations in the Caribbean and Latin America were financed and organized from here. So New York was very much at the center of the slave empire, even at the time of the Civil War. And so for me, it's important to remember all of that because New York City still hasn't overcome the legacies of slavery or the shadow of slavery. We still live in it.
For decades, you have been a leader in the fight for equality and racial justice in our city. Why have you committed yourself to serving the public?
Well, for a variety of reasons, but one is I spent much of my life, my early years, living with my grandparents on a small piece of property that my grandmother's great-grandfather bought in 1860. And it was a small town in Pennsylvania on the Maryland border and Delaware border. And the town was populated largely by Quakers. And it was a big center for the Underground Railroad. Many of the homes in the area still have hiding places for runaway slaves. And my own family, my mother's and grandmother's family, fled slavery in Maryland around 1800 and settled in this town. And every year we would commemorate the Quakers and descendants of runaways, black and white, together. We'd commemorate that whole history of fighting against slavery. And we'd have picnics at houses that still had the caves or hidden places for slaves. And then at night, people who still had those hiding places in their houses would put candles in their windows and we'd walk around. And what it all brought home to me was how my family's freedom was really connected to the willingness of these other people to join with runaway slaves and to fight for freedom. And I'm talking about the Quakers. And I feel the same kind of spirit or obligation to work for freedom and justice for other people, because otherwise I would not have anything or be able to do what I do. That's why I do it. And I think the civil rights movement tackled only a few policy areas, because you can't do everything at once. They focused a lot on education discrimination and housing discrimination, some unemployment discrimination. But in New York City, we have 50 agencies. And most of those areas haven't been really examined or dug into. Like, how does that help produce inequality? How does that help produce racial disparities or gender disparities or other things? Really is unknown because there's so little work done on it. So I also feel like it's challenging intellectually too, to try and think through how do we create a truly just society, having been a slave country and a racially segregated country and a country epitomizing inequality? How do we actually make it the democracy that the Declaration of Independence talks about? I think that's challenging.
Deputy Mayor, you serve as the co-chair on the city's Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, or TREE, and as the commissioner on the city's Racial Justice Commission, or RJC. The mission of TREE and RJC align with the mission of your life's work. Can you please talk a little bit about what these two efforts are doing to address racial injustice in New York City?
Well, the Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity, or TREE, as we call it, is composed of commissioners, deputy commissioners, other high-ranking officials in different agencies, and the First Lady. And it's really focused on things that the city can do right away that help bring about greater equality or greater opportunity in New York, particularly for people of color in New York City. So the mayor funded an initiative to extend affordable broadband to 600,000 people, many of whom live in public housing and didn't have access to broadband. And we offered assistance to restaurant owners of color who were hard hit during the pandemic. And we've opened up centers for childcare and health, vaccinations and other things in the hardest hit neighborhoods, which tended to be neighborhoods of color in the city, and literally dozens of other initiatives to really address inequality, racial inequality in the city. The Commission on Racial Justice is actually a charter revision commission with the legal power to propose amendments to the charter, the city charter, which is like the city's constitution. And that group has 11 people appointed by the mayor, Black, Latino, Asian. And that group is really exploring something I mentioned earlier. They're really exploring the ways in which the city charter itself embeds racial inequality, and we call it structural inequality because it's in the charter. And our mandate is really to explore this question. Do we do capital investment equitably? Are our infrastructure plans equitable? Going beyond areas where there's been a lot of focus, like school segregation, for example, into areas where there hasn't been so much. So we're looking at everything. And then from there, trying to figure out, okay, what do we want to tackle first? And also, how do we actually engage the entire city in a conversation about racial inequality? All with the aim of sort of making folks more aware of why some folks continue to have obstacles and barriers to try and succeed in New York City and why others find it easier to succeed. And what are the things we can do with greater commitment in order to make this a more fair, but also a more together, a more friendly, a more community-oriented city.
Hey there, this is Bess. I want to welcome our final guest for this episode, Sadia Sherman. In 2020, Sadia was appointed executive director of the city's Task Force on Racial Inclusion and Equity. The task force was launched in response to the racial disparities laid bare by the COVID-19 pandemic. As executive director, Ms. Sherman works across city agencies to advance new programs, policies, and initiatives that center equity in the city's ongoing response and ensure the communities hardest hit by COVID-19 come back stronger. Sadia also serves as Executive Vice President for Community Engagement and Partnerships at the New York City Housing Authority, otherwise known as NYCHA. In this capacity, she oversees a partnership-based collective impact model for engaging and connecting public housing residents to economic opportunities and services across 6 departments. I spoke with Sadia about her work leading TREE and what it means to her to serve her city at such a critical time. I want to welcome Sadia Sherman to City Hall Pass. Sadia, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Sadia, you are the executive director of the city's Task Force for Racial Inclusion and Equity, otherwise known as TREE. Tell us a little bit about the mission of TREE and what the task force is doing to address racial disparities in our city.
The task force was formed last April in response to COVID and specifically in response to the racial disparities that were really seen throughout the pandemic. So we saw that communities of color were particularly hit hard. Certain neighborhoods were hit hard. And this was not unique to New York, certainly, you know, it was the case nationally. But what we saw were that many of these disparities that have been persistent in our society that are rooted in systemic racism really played out during the pandemic. In New York, our work has focused on 33, what we call hard-hit communities. And I'm sure if I ask the average New Yorker what communities those are, right, they'd probably be able to name them. It's communities like Harlem, which I live in, Brownsville, East New York, Chinatown, Jackson Heights, right? A lot of the neighborhoods where there were high rates of fatality, but also neighborhoods that have had other disparities, right? Whether it be economic, health disparities, high proportion of frontline workers, et cetera. So the task force was really convened to, one, you know, certainly help inform the city's response to COVID and eventual recovery, but
also to make sure that we were driving resources to the communities that needed it the most. And also thinking about how to address some of these other underlying systemic issues that were rooted in, you know, what we saw played out. The task force has announced a number of initiatives, I want to say probably over 30 at this point. And they've ranged from, you know, mental health resiliency workshops in hard hit communities to new COVID centers of excellence. So these are brick and mortar healthcare centers, which have been led by H&H. There have been new executive orders put in place around MWB contracting and services for MWB businesses. And then we have some new initiatives, one of which I'm really excited about, called Tree Neighborhoods, where we're supporting local community-based coalitions in all 33 neighborhoods to really continue to inform our response and eventual recovery.
What does it mean to you to serve as executive director for the Task Force for Racial Inclusion and Equity?
It means so much for me to be able to serve the city in this way at this time. You know, prior to becoming ED of the task force, I've been executive vice president at NYCHA, and, you know, 80% of NYCHA residents live in task force communities. So there's a lot of overlap already. And, you know, and a lot of what I saw firsthand during COVID, you know, really translates to what we saw in communities at large. Personally, it means everything to me as a woman, as a Black woman in the city, to be able to serve in this capacity. But I think one of the things that's also really unique and exciting about the task force is that it brings together leaders from across the city, but particularly leaders of color, right? And we're having difficult conversations, very frank conversations. A lot of folks who've been working on the task force come from these 33 neighborhoods. So it's really, you know, not just serving in a professional capacity, but there's a lot of personal commitment to it.
How has your work at the New York City Housing Authority prepared you to lead this task force?
Sure. So, you know, NYCHA obviously is first and foremost the landlord, but I would say that, you know, working at NYCHA, you're not only familiar with housing and affordable housing policy, but you really have to be familiar with every facet of the city, right? We have a larger social mission. A lot of the work, and particularly the work that my team does, is very interagency connected, right? So we work across the city around ensuring residents are accessing social services and community-based services. There's probably not a city agency that I don't already work with. So performing this work on behalf of the task force, I'm working with many colleagues who I've worked with for years. And, you know, I think working at NYCHA, you also have a sense of how people experience the city, right? So it's not just where you live, but it's also how you interact with a variety of city functions. You know, I think that that has particularly prepared me for this work. And then really being, you know, frontline to COVID at NYCHA and really understanding our team was making person-to-person phone calls, knocking on doors, providing food delivery. So really had understanding from my personal experience and my work at NYCHA of just how communities were impacted. And so moving into this role, you know, I'm certainly able to carry that experience over.
What does Juneteenth mean to you?
Sure. So, you know, my family's from the South, not from Texas, but from Florida and the Virginia area. And so, you know, I come from that lineage of formerly enslaved Africans in this country. As a child growing up in America, right, you learn a lot about American history. You learn about our founding fathers. You celebrate the 4th of July. But there's always like this asterisk, right? Like that while these amazing things happen, and while these great ideals were set forth for our country, there were humans enslaved. And so that has always been something that, you know, has been my understanding of my identity as an American and the way I connect to our American history, right? Like always understanding that there's this subtext of literally enslaved people in this country. And so when I learned about Juneteenth, I was probably in my early 20s or late teens. And I was like, what is this holiday? I didn't know about this, right? Like you learn about the Emancipation Proclamation, but you really don't understand the nuance that there were still territories under Confederate control and just like all the complexity of that. And so my sister actually for years had celebrated Juneteenth with like an annual Juneteenth dinner. And she would bring like family, friends over, and folks would learn about the holiday and what it means. You know, it's almost like a second Independence Day in this country. And I think it's important not only for me as a Black American or not only for New Yorkers or folks from Texas or other regions of the country. I think it's really an important holiday for every American because it demonstrates an important moment in time when we were starting to get closer to realizing our ideals and our values and what we espouse to be as a country. And so it feels to me even more exciting than some of the other holidays that we have. And I'm glad to see that it's begun to rise in prominence and hope that it continues to do so.
Sidhia, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on City Hall Pass.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I want to thank our guests today, the First Lady of New York City, Shirlane McCrae, Deputy Mayor Phil Thompson, and Sadia Sherman, for taking time out of their busy schedules to educate all of us on Juneteenth and the powerful work of the Task Force for Racial Inclusion and Equity. For more information on Juneteenth, please visit nyc.gov/Juneteenth. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you soon on another great episode of City Hall Pass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.